Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Hello, I'm Steve Evans. Welcome to Business Daily. In the programme today, the world's Mr. Computers on you and his product.
We will live in a world in which we will speak to our computers, we will gesture to our computers. Our computers won't just understand what we said, they'll start to understand what we mean.
Plus, has India really opened up?
There's huge excitement among investors about India because they've nowhere else to go. But they still find getting into this country a significant challenge.
All in Business Daily from the BBC. Let's start with a bit of a quiz. Please identify our first guest. He is without doubt one of the world's top business leaders. His company is probably the most famous on the planet. Probably, you can debate it. He is very excitable.
Who said sit down? I have four words for you. I love this company. Yes!
It is, of course, Steve Ballmer. And the company to which he's wedded, almost literally by the sound of it, is Microsoft, of which Mr. Ballmer, of course, is chief executive. He is, by the best reckoning, within the top 50 of the richest people on the planet, but worked his way up from a solid middle-class upbringing in Detroit, where he remains on the board of a school. Microsoft, of course, is at the very centre of the global economy, a pivot, really. Its systems run more than 90% of desktop computers, so most of us literally touch Mr. Ballmer's products every day of our lives. He's a good man to turn to for a sense of how the economic world is currently turning. The big question at the moment, of course, is, are we coming out of recession for good, or might we fall back in with a second dip, as it were? That's the question our business editor, Robert Peston, put to him.
I'm feeling more confident, not that we're going to recover, but I'm feeling more confident that we're not going to feel another shock. Because if you take a look historically, sometimes these massive economic turmoils have had multiple shocks, if you will.
Some business leaders are very worried that there will be what we call a double dip, a second dip. For example, the chief executive of HSBC, he is preparing for a second downturn. You wouldn't be that pessimistic.
Right now, I feel like we're not likely to see a second dip. I think modern economic science has come far enough that I believe government globally and the central banks globally will help us avoid that.
And when you say you're not expecting, do you just mean we're going to bump along the bottom for a bit? Is that what you fear?
That's right.
For how long do you think we're going to get this lower growth or this bumping along the bottom?
I think it could be a significant time period.
So years?
Yes.
A lot of business people that I talk to, therefore, are somewhat bemused by the extraordinary jump we've seen in share prices. Would you have that same fear that this 50% rise we've seen in share prices is ahead of the real recovery in business?
I would share that view. The market has its own dynamics, which are hard to explain. You know, certainly I think one of the things government has done to try to avoid a second dip around the world is to provide plenty of money into the system. And it could be that that money is doing more to support the stock market than anything else going.
Now, this is a big couple of years for you, and I want to talk a bit about the whole stream of things that are coming out for you. But just in terms of the basics, there was a very sharp fall in sales for you, particularly in the fourth quarter of last year. Has that now stabilized?
There was a drop in sales. We've had no drop in sales, so the fact that we had one means people would call it sharp.
By your standards, let's be clear.
By our standard sharp, we were down a few percent for the first time. That's right.
And has it stabilized now?
We've definitely seen stabilization. Now, in our business, it is about the economy, but it's also about new product. And we've got Windows 7, we've got Bing, we've got a new generation of Windows mobile phones, we've got a new generation of our Xbox technologies in the market. We're pretty loaded with innovation that should also help us beat the market, so to speak.
What's your own view about how fast we will move away from the traditional idea that all data and processes are stored on a personal computer and how fast we'll move towards this so-called cloud concept, where much of what we do is actually stored in servers well away from the physical computer we use. How fast do you think we'll move in that direction?
I believe in cloud computing, but I actually don't believe we're going to move to a world where it feels like things are away from us now. I think we're going to move to the proper world where we're going to balance where things are stored and what we're doing between our phone, our PC, even our television set, and the cloud. And we're using the cloud more and more for email, for storage of pictures. But there's still plenty of reasons why, for speed, for performance, for user interface. You just want to have things locally.
We've talked a bit about the tough economic conditions. You've also got one or two fairly formidable competitors out there, Google to name just one. Does it feel, I mean, you've been in the industry for some time, does this feel like the toughest market that Microsoft has ever faced?
No. No, they don't.
Why not?
Well, this is a world in which there's one business, search, in which Google is very strong. And sure, it's the toughest competition. We have, I think, here in the UK, 3% market share, and they have 85. But in a sense, that's kind of fun. Every day's a good day. We get a chance every day to improve. It's not so bad. In the other areas, Google has essentially no market share.
But it's desperately trying to get into your areas,
sure,
though. I mean, it's investing money in its own operating system. It thinks that the cloud is going to eventually make you redundant. You don't fear that kind of...
We've had plenty of competitors come after us for years. There's nothing magic about Google. We've had good, well-funded competitors before. I mean, the most formidable competitor I ever thought we ever had was IBM in the early 90s when we had to go with Windows against OS 2. They were big, they were funded, they had brand, they had everything going for them, and we didn't have any real momentum yet with our Windows product. That was scary. At this stage, come on, we're strong in operating systems. If Google wants to launch two new operating systems, we're going to make Windows the best place on the planet.
Now, you spend this colossal amount, I think it's over $9 billion on research and development. Is that, I think
that's correct.
The right kind of ballpark number. Looking 5 years out, because you've got people who look 5-10 years out, What are we going to be seeing from you?
I think there's two different ways to characterize it. You could say, what are the new applications? How's it going to be different? Look at this interview. You're sitting there with a piece of paper and a pencil, not with some electronic device. Why? It's because we don't yet make technology that you find more comfortable in this kind of note-taking, annotation setting.
That's also partly anything electronic will react with this sound system.
Okay.
To solve that problem before
that's another problem we get a chance. But I'm trying to say, whether it's
sure,
meetings, note-taking,
sure,
reading, there's so many things that we get to solve. Entertainment, reading, media consumption, business data, communications, collaboration, all will evolve. But perhaps the thing we'll all notice the most is the change in the way we do computing. We will have new places to store and manage information that will simplify our lives. We will live in a world in which we will speak to our computers. We will gesture to our computers. Our computers won't just understand what we said. They'll start to understand what we mean. All of that will see significant progress over the next 5 years, and that's the kind of stuff we're investing in.
So there we are, Steve Ballmer, the man who picked up the reins from Bill Gates, of course, the founder of Microsoft. What then about the man who gave Bill Gates the reins in the first place? I refer, of course, to William Gates Sr., the father who brought up the prodigy. Quite a feat of parenthood, you might think.
I'd say it was a very typical parent-child relationship in which we were endeavoring to impose limits and he was restive and irritated about being restricted. So it wasn't free of conflict. We had to work at that. There was a lot of friction at points in time.
Over what kind of things? I imagine the age we're looking at is, I don't know, 13, 14. That's the bad age for boys, isn't it?
Well, it is. But as a matter of fact, in Bill's case, this started at around 11, where he became a very independent creature, thinking for himself, all of which was part of his resistance to being directed, being disciplined. He matured psychologically very, very early.
Can you think of an incident where he and you bumped up against each other?
I could think of a lot of those. He had a room in the basement where his bedroom was, and we lived upstairs, two-story house. We were going out, and we were going to be late waiting for the car, waiting for him to come up. Finally, we hollered down and said, Bill, what are you doing? We've got to get going. And he called back up to us, and he said, I'm thinking. Don't you ever think? Mary and I looked at each other, and we sort of wondered to ourselves, maybe we don't ever think. I'm not so sure.
I note as well that you were born in 1925, which means that you were aware anyway as a child of the Depression, and certainly your parents were, and you would have been aware of the values that they had from that. How did that inform your upbringing and the way you brought your kids up?
The Depression in 1929 and the early 30s was very, very significant and long-lasting, and a very high percentage of people in this country were without jobs and poor and trying hard to figure out a way to get the next meal. Times were really terrible. I mean, what we've been going through over the last year or so is not a lot of fun either, but it doesn't have the same depth nor the same duration of what was happening in the early 30s.
And you take the view that there should be a strong estate tax so that the generations can't pass on their wealth to their children.
Yes, that's correct. I don't think there's any great societal value in passing tens of millions of dollars to children. I will say that. But I think more to the point is that people with the kind of wealth which is subject to the estate tax are people who have had the enjoyment of enormous investments made by society, all of the wonderful research and activities that create business success, business wealth, the kind of wealth that becomes subject to the estate tax, is largely dependent upon conditions, innovations that society provides, things like the internet. It just seems to me it's kind of a simple matter of recognizing that where all this wealth came from is there's a claim on it. It should go back in the form of estate taxes for supporting that society, supporting higher education, supporting the National Institutes of Health, society's contribution in the form of taxes.
I've got a friend who, when I put that kind of argument to him, he says, look, I've got a right. I work to pass it on to my children. That's my right. It's what I work for, to make sure my kids are going to be okay. What would you say to him?
Well, we all have views about what our rights are, I guess. I just think if you look at the realities of society, it's an exaggeration to assert that everything that happens to you in your life, everything good, everything material, is something that you have the right and society has the obligation to let you pass it on to children. I don't think that's a great good in society, as I've already suggested, but more to the point, you know, we organize the society in a way that to try to generate good economic activity and some prosperity, and it's the reinvestment that is created by society with its tax dollars that makes it possible for people to prosper.
William Henry Gates Sr. and his thoughts are published as Showing Up for Life, Thoughts on the Gifts of a Lifetime. If you've got thoughts on that, perhaps on estate tax, taxing inheritance, send them to world.business@bbc.co.uk. And you're listening to Business Daily from the BBC with Steve Evans. Now, why isn't India as attractive to outside companies as China is? It's not a question of my own, but one which the Indian government itself is asking. And on the Indian Ministry of Finance's own website, in its, quote, info for government employees section, the Ministry of Finance adds in what seems like an unlikely sales pitch to me, quote, foreign investors should be prepared to take India as it is, with all of its difficulties, contradictions and challenges. We asked the Doyen of India correspondence, the BBC's Mark Tully, for his take on all this.
The problem isn't a shortage of investors, nor is it Dr. Manmohan Singh's lack of enthusiasm for foreign investment. It's the Indian government's way of doing business. Mark Runnickers, the Confederation of British Industry's Indian advisor, told me there's huge excitement among investors about India because they'd nowhere else to go. But they still find getting into this country a significant challenge. He also told me of a major international company operating in over 70 countries, which had spoken of the bureaucratic and burdensome regulatory business environment in India, which makes it the most difficult market in the world for us to do business in. There are some big-ticket items which, in his previous government, Manmohan Singh wanted to open up to foreign investors, but couldn't, because the communists objected. There was increasing foreign investment in insurance companies to 49%, allowing more than 10% voting rights in banks, and the vexed question of retail. The American giant Walmart have come into India as wholesalers, and the British supermarket firm Tesco's are knocking hard on the door. But there is still no sign that either will be able to open a chain of stores. Foreign investors suspect that Indian companies, whose ventures into modern retailing haven't been as successful as expected, might well be behind the government's continuing refusal to move on this one. International investors hope the finance minister might give at least an indication of progress on some of these investment opportunities when he presented his first budget, but he didn't. But the biggest problem is still transparency in all the processes involved in investing, and that's compounded by the need to obtain so many licenses. It's not that clearance for investment is refused, but the process of getting clearance turns out to be never-ending. And that, of course, is expensive as well as frustrating for potential investors. And to add to all this, even though the communists cannot shackle Manmohan Singh any longer, he does still have coalition partners who make his life difficult. Under the last government, complications over purchasing land stalled several large industrial projects and slowed down the vital road-building programme. The new government had circulated a fresh land acquisition bill to MPs, but withdrew it after a shouting match between the finance minister and the fiery railway minister from West Bengal, Mamata Banerjee. Her unique selling point is opposing land purchases on the grounds that they don't safeguard the rights of the owners, and that in effect means opposing almost any land purchase. On lands, on licences, on transparency. So far, there's no sign that international investors are going to have it any easier than they did when Manmohan's hand was stayed by the communists. But it has to be said, these are still early days. This is Mark Tully for the BBC World Service.
And may I recommend our website, www.bbcworldservice.com, where there's business news, of course, constantly updated, and you can download the Business Daily podcast. And also, don't forget, of course, world.business@bbc.co.uk for emails.
There's a BBC podcast for every area of business.
I'm Roger Hearing with the latest business news from the BBC.
From today's world business news to global trends with Peter Day.
So I've made a trip to the new China to see what impact credit crunch is having here.
And from the top of the morning.
Welcome to Wake Up to Money with Mickey Clark.
Hello, I'm Leslie Kerwin. Welcome to Business Daily.
To the bottom line.
Who makes money when boom turns to bust?
Download your choice of BBC business podcasts at bbc.co.uk/podcasts.